Does that work? Okay, very good. First, it's good to be back in Missouri. I was here on the faculty for, I guess, almost 7 years, right at it, before going on to Florida and then on to Smithfield Foods. So it's good to see a lot of familiar faces and reacquaint myself with some folks I haven't seen in quite a while. When I got asked to put some of these thoughts together, I guess I took a step back from a perspective prior to me entering the swine industry. What thoughts and what perspectives have I developed over the years that may be interesting if you weren't involved with the pig industry? And so I've tried to do some of that. We'll see if I've succeeded or not here over the next few minutes. And then try and translate maybe some of that to some current emphasis that you guys are having in the area of beef cattle. We've heard a lot about residual feed intake. And then maybe pick up on Mike McNeil's last bullet point. Be careful for what you ask for, because I certainly believe you're going to get it if you head down the path of selection. Probably prior to doing that, probably give you some background as at least to what kind of my perspective is on the overall business structure of the swine industry today. The friends I have in various agricultural sectors, and I tell you, as I moved into the swine business, I probably had a misperception of how it's organized, how it's kind of run on a routine basis from a business perspective, and how it's overall structured. And that structure's continued to change over the last few years, and I think it's going to continue to change more as we move forward. This particular slide, and I hope it's visible towards the back of the room, National Hog Farmer Magazine every year publishes a list of the top 20 U.S. swine producers. They call it pork powerhouses. And it's really kind of an interesting list. For the most part, the list is made up of what I would call integrated live production hog businesses. And happens so that some of those also own packing businesses. The top three of these do: Smithfield Foods, Triumph, and Seaboard, with Triumph having a slaughter facility up in St. Joe. Several interesting things, I think, about this particular slide. Really, the first one of those that jumps out at you, if you look at it for very long, is that over that period of time, there's been a fairly consistent reduction in U.S. sow herd inventory. And I've got a couple of other slides that will illustrate that. This is actually sow numbers. So this would be the active sow inventory for each of those businesses within that current year of 2009. If you go down through there, there's been about a 5 to 15% reduction, depending upon the specific business, in active sow inventory. And obviously, all of us that have been involved in livestock production over the last couple of years know that it's been a particularly rough time. It's been terribly rough on the swine business, pork production business in general, and that's led to some involuntary and also some voluntary reduction in the breeding herd inventory. So if we look at the current U.S. swine breeding herd, today it's around 5.75 million sows. That is down. If you look at the graph on the right, this is a graph I borrowed from Steve Meyer's Daily Livestock Newsletter, and it shows, get my keys right, continually decline in U.S. sow herd active inventories. And then this is actually pig numbers from U.S. pig numbers. What you'll notice is that is on a steep decline down, and then really kind of as a side item to that, productivity has really remained fairly constant, if arguably if it hasn't increased at the same time. To kind of put it more in perspective, that previous list on the previous slide, those top 10 producers control about 40% of the U.S. sow herd inventory. Okay? We could go on down further into that list in the top 20, and obviously that number grows. If we go back to those names on that slide, I'd tell you just from a high-level perspective, those are very well-run businesses. We've talked a lot about cost today. I can tell you that every one of those businesses understand their cost to a very detailed level on every fiscal month in their calendar year. It's really fairly impressive. And because they can do that, they can hone in on that and make the system much more efficient. those systems, there's also another misperception about a lot of those systems, is that they're all company-owned type of facilities, and it's a totally company-owned type of production mechanism. All of those companies on that previous slide are made up of some company farms, but for the most part, they're made up of a lot of contract farmers and growers. So it's a very wide array of people involved in the business. If we look at the last couple of years in terms of the business climate and kind of what has resulted from that, we have seen that reduction in hog numbers in the U.S., even more so in Canada. They've even gone through a more drastic reduction over periods of time. And a couple of other things that I think we've kind of come to conclusion of as a business, as a broader and bigger business. In the past, export markets would have been relied on a fair amount as a pretty reasonable source of margin. Here I've got China and Russia listed. There's a couple of folks from PIC here, and I know they're well aware of that. Over the last couple of years, those countries have invested quite a bit in infrastructure in terms of facilities, feed manufacturing, and purchasing genetic inputs to grow their own internal production needs. I think we view as a bigger business that those export markets going forward, we just can't simply rely on them as a constant source of sales. It's been interesting as we've gone through this last cycle of really economic stress. There have been big businesses that have exited the hog production business. I can think of two companies in North Carolina that cumulatively are about 60,000 sows worth of production. They've exited the business. Most of those facilities have remained idle up through today. A couple of other realizations that we've come to. We're going to talk a little bit about feed utilization, because I think that if you asked our financial group, they would tell you that they've come to the conclusion that we've probably reached a step change and a new plateau in feed cost. I think they've come to the realization we're not going to see $2 corn again, and that, you know, 3.25 may be a more reasonable target for us to look at, and even though it may bounce around that going forward. And of course, from a regulatory standpoint, from at the state and federal level both, production agriculture has not been treated, I don't think, very friendly. And all of those regulatory impacts that hit our system, they all come at a cost, and they make us less competitive. And I think we're going to have more of those as we move forward over the next couple of years. So, a little bit about the business that I'm involved with, Smithfield Foods. Start back on the live hog production side. That business is Murphy Brown LLC, and in the United States we have a little bit less than 1 million sows. That comprises a little bit south of 20% of the U.S. sow herd. Again, that's made up of company-owned sow farms, contract growers that operate those facilities all the way through the finishing system. It's an integrated system then those pigs are passed on to one of three various slaughter businesses or harvesting businesses, Farmland Foods, who you're familiar with probably more so in this region, Smithfield Packing, and John Morrell. Outside of the integrated pigs that we produce, we also, from a packing business perspective, purchase quite a few pigs outside of that production system, as well as we would also sell pigs to other production or packing businesses as well, such as Hormel. We have a couple of JV businesses in Mexico that are cumulatively about 100,000 sows and about 100,000 sows worth of production in Eastern Europe. So to kind of more the genetics piece, which is more specifically what I'm involved with, within that overall structure, Smithfield has an internal business unit, specifically focused on genetics. And our charge from corporate is that we, whether it's internal or whether through external negotiations, we provide the most effective, most cost-efficient genetic inputs to our system. And if we can't do that, we find somebody that can. In doing that, we operate a number of purebred farms, if you will, nucleus farms across the U.S., that house the seed stock that we disseminate across the system. We have a staff of various geneticists trained at the PhD and master's level. We also have within our business, a number of nutritionists, physiologists, meat scientists back on the packing side that we interact with routinely in terms of trying to design the best product for the system. We also, from a research perspective, we do quite a bit of internal R&D. And then we also collaborate with a number of universities and federal research agencies within the U.S. and across the globe to kind of complete our overall objectives. So, really efficiency in general, certainly it is important. To further kind of illustrate this and really efficiency of production, specifically over the last couple of years, this top graph is something John Lawrence up at Iowa State puts together and keeps fairly current. And this is estimated returns for a farrow-to-finish operation, really kind of on a U.S. basis, that he tracks and monitors. And if you look really over the last 2 years, you see that on a finished pig basis, that those margins are negative as much as in the ballpark of about $60 a pig. And I can tell you our business went through a fair amount of that. And those estimates are based on cash grain prices and cash market values, which in reality, most businesses don't operate that way. You're involved in hedging activities and other sorts of things that cause bigger swings around these baseline numbers. And of course, this really corresponds to this spike in increased grain costs that we've seen over the last couple of years. For the most part, it has. From a Smithfield perspective, it's impacted our business the same way. I just happened to pull off our stock price. We're a publicly traded company on the New York Stock Exchange. And you can see through this same period of time we took quite a hit and really haven't recovered yet from a stock price standpoint relative to where we were of an all-time high back around 2005. So, feed efficiency or feed conversion. Want to rethink the definition a little bit and maybe raise a few questions as we go through the next few minutes as you guys think about how you're going to utilize that in a selection perspective. So, by definition, pounds of feed consumed over pounds of gain realized. Certainly common to everyone here. I challenge you to think about a little bit more from a commercial perspective. One of the things that I get to see now very routinely are group closeouts. From a business perspective, that's how we measure whether we're being successful or not. Everything that we've, at least I think I've heard talked about today, we've talked about individual animal selection, which is certainly makes sense. But at the end of the day, we have to understand or ask ourselves the question, are we going to realize commercial level genetic gain? And the only way you're going to realize commercial level genetic gain is evaluating your group closeouts. Whether it's a finishing closeout I might look at on a group of pigs, or if it's a finishing closeout you might look at on a group of cattle you own and fed in a commercial feed yard. And so we typically look at that on a group basis really in pretty much the same way. Pounds of feed consumed or pounds of feed really delivered, I don't know whether they consume it or not, it's what's delivered to the site because we measure that, over the difference between pounds placed and pounds actually sold or marketed. And so on a big system macro level, that's how we monitor whether we're being successful or not. In those computations, you don't get any credit for animals that die or culls that leave the system. Okay? If an animal consumes all the way up prior to the day it was supposed to go to market and it results in a mortality, that's a credit that gets taken away from the system. You still realize the feed cost, but you didn't realize any of the revenue from that. And as we go through the next couple of slides, most of the time, individual efficiency doesn't equal group efficiency. Very rarely. At least in our production system, it doesn't. And I don't think in most that it does. Just in passing, I mentioned a few other things from a non-genetics perspective, really kind of the low-hanging fruit that we deal with for improving efficiency, really starts at feed manufacturing. It's a huge cost for our business. Poultry would tell you the same thing. There's numerous amounts of research that we have continually ongoing to try and better understand, are we delivering exactly the right feed stuff at the particular time in the system to maximize efficiency. And a lot of that deals with particle size of the nutrient we're delivering, the appropriate pellet size. Of course, these things come at a cost, and we're sensitive to the cost we spend on any extra feed manufacturing. Does it deliver value back to the system? Not a very good picture, but this is basically a hog feeder. And I just want to make the point here that in our system, feed gets delivered to the sites. It's not manufactured locally at the site. It gets delivered from a central mill. And so the point it leaves the mill, are there any inefficiencies in the system between then and the time it gets consumed by the pig? And that includes being sure that all of our equipment is operating sufficiently, that we don't have any leaks in storage or bins, and that they're certainly up to date with respect to maintenance, and then the augers that deliver the feed stuff through the system, and then really all the way down to the settings of the feeders themselves. That's really kind of a big deal if you ask some of our production service people. One of the things they do whenever they go into a site are being sure these feeders are adjusted exactly to our specifications. The last thing we want to do is go into a site, see this filled entirely up with feed and feed spilling over and running out into the pit. More on an individual animal basis, what are some of the things that we know about the system and the specific animals that we deal with? No different than cattle. There's certainly a gender difference with respect to individual efficiency. Barrows grow faster. They have higher desire to eat and intake. They have higher intake. They're usually a little bit more robust, and they're also fatter. They don't have quite as desirable a level of primal yield as a gilt. I borrowed these couple of graphs from some of Alan Schinkel's work over at Purdue. And if you look at that, look at this graph. This is predicted feed-to-gain ratio on this y-axis, okay, for barrows and gilts. And you'll notice within this, he's classified basically what I would call composition genotypes, this line being a leaner genotype and this being a fatter genotype. And, of course, on an individual animal basis, much like what we would expect to see in cattle, is those leaner genotypes on an individual animal basis are probably more efficient. So we know that about our system. Some other things that we know. This is actually data that I pulled from about a year's worth of closeouts from our finishing system. And again, this is group lot closeout information. So on the y-axis, we have feed conversion. And then on the x-axis, we have group livability and average daily gain. And clearly what you see in that data, and I think it all makes sense, is there's a very strong relationship between those two production component traits and feed conversion. And again, this would be the important metric that we would be interested in. This is a group dynamic. This is the true cost and revenue realized by the system. Okay? So livability is a big driver of this. Obviously, the greater degree of livability we have, and most of the livabilities, you know, of our group closeout is going to be over in here, and average daily gain is going to be over in here. But for those that aren't, it becomes a real significant cost to the system. Okay. This is probably the one slide that I want to try and at least raise a couple of questions with. These are a couple of questions we deal with. And I'll share with you how we select for intake and make those decisions from a genetic basis here in just a moment. So, if we select on an individual animal basis for an animal that has a great propensity for, let's say, lean gain, or is a very efficient animal, given the opportunity to express all of its genetic potential, that it truly would be efficient. What we have kind of come to believe, that in a very conventional type of production system, given the environmental stressors that we deal with, no difference, been mentioned a couple of times today, that here a week ago it was 95 degrees here in Missouri. Animals don't have a great desire to eat and grow during those sorts of conditions. So that's an environmental stressor that's a part of this equation. Disease stress. We have bouts with various diseases that we deal with that'll suppress intake. Pigs get sick, they don't want to eat. Steers get sick, they don't want to eat. What we have kind of come to through numerous research projects and kind of convinced ourselves are, is that those animals that present that really lean, efficient type of genotype, they're more sensitive to those environmental stressors. And again, I'm thinking about the realized commercial level gain. If we took a lean type of genotype and really imposed whatever stressors to reduce intake, that becomes a problematic area for us. And I think, as at least our nutritionists believe, and we've had several discussions about this, that it really comes down to nutrient partitioning. Let's take, for example, you have two genotypes. Genotype A, or boar A, or animal A, or whatever, is a very desirable lean-to-gain ratio, super efficient animal, given that it's going to have the opportunity to express that genetic potential. Okay? Animal B, maybe a little bit fatter type of genotype, has probably the same rough desire to eat, same amount of intake potential, probably in that full genetic expression potential environment, may grow a little bit slower than the leaner one. When we put them in more of a commercial type of setting, okay, and expose them to some stress, what we end up, or at least what we think we end up seeing, is that those two animals may have roughly the same maintenance requirements the same way. In fact, the lean genotype probably has a little bit higher maintenance requirement. Okay? Those first incremental amounts of feed have to go to satisfy that maintenance requirement. They have to. Okay? And whatever's left then goes to lean gain, and if there's anything left, it's going to go to fat. So if I do anything in the system to push down intake, okay, that leaves less left to go to lean gain. And then ultimately that component gives me a different answer in a group of animals for feed conversion. And probably also average daily gain as well. So we've kind of come to that conclusion and thrown up some question marks as to, for us, that's probably not necessarily the right approach. So how do we go through that? Some very simplistic approaches that we utilize. As I mentioned before, we're continually charged with, to be sure, on a, think of it as a breed basis, that we're putting the right genes in the system to create that next generation and drive genetic progress forward. So one of the things that my group routinely does is we're all the time testing various breeds from different producers, genetic lines from retail companies, to try and be sure we have the right genetic pig in the system. And what we do is we actually monitor that on a commercial level. We'll go into a commercial sow farm, do side-by-side matings, track the pigs all the way through the system, measure pen feed efficiency, and statistically design it so we can get that information back. All this graph is are just a handful of some of the sire line trials we've done where we track growth and feed conversion really on more of a group dynamic type of basis. Okay? And then we make decisions whether we have the right product or not based on some of these really, they're very simple sorts of trials, but they're very effective. From a commercial level improvement standpoint, typically how we are structured as a breeding division is we're really at this part of the production pyramid. Probably everyone in here is very familiar with this and have seen this explained in numerous other meetings or animal science classes in the past, but this is a typical production pyramid within the Smithfield system. Our purebred operations are up here. That's purebred animals. They're not crossbred. They operate at a different health status, if you will, or at least monitored at a different level than the rest of the system. And I would say that animals probably have, on a day-in, day-out basis, the ability for greater genetic expression at that level. So in our genetic improvement system over the last several years, we've become very convinced that there's quite a bit of genotype by environment interaction that goes on in the system. And so what we've done is kind of, if you will, exploited the integrated system and said, hey, we need to be catching data from down in here and also on further into packing to drive our genetic decisions back up at the nucleus level. And so what we do is we actually create pigs that we can track through the system that provide meaningful genetic data on an individual animal basis, back up through here in the EPD computation process and the selection index process that drive our selection. Okay? It's a great program. It's one that we use, at least from a terminal genetic standpoint, to push genetic progress forward. This graph over here, the only point I'm trying to make is these are EPDs for days to market from purebred animals in this environment, and these are EPDs for age-adjusted carcass weight on this axis over here from this part of the system. So days to market, a lower number is better. Animals grow faster, get there quicker. A greater carcass weight on an age-adjusted basis would indicate more growth. If there was no genotype by environment interaction, or if we were evaluating everything here exactly as we would see it here, there'd be a straight line of dots down through this diagonal. Okay? We certainly don't see that. We see animals that in the commercial level, for whatever reason, have greater growth than we see in the nucleus purebred situation, and we also see the opposite of that as well. So, that's really on an individual animal basis how we the approach we use to drive individual genetic progress. So how do we deal with intake? I mentioned how we utilize it at the commercial level to be sure we're evaluating the right products or using the right products in the system. We do measure individual animal consumption at the purebred level. It's a system very much like some of you saw the GrowSafe system up at Circle A Feeders yesterday. It operates under the same concepts. Pigs have RFID tags. This happens to be a little group of Duroc boars. They go into this system one at a time. They have the opportunity to eat. It gets recorded, and we get those data back, and they're available for EPD computation. We're challenged with how do we use those data. And I'm here to tell you it's still a big question mark for us on an individual animal basis and then also on the group type of dynamic that we want to achieve. We do utilize the data in multiple trait models because all the expected relationships are there, and we monitor that data to be sure we're not getting outside of what I'd call windows of acceptability on intake and be sure we're not creating a pig that has a lack of a desire to eat. So we do utilize it that way as well. But it's still a big, tough question for us, really driven off the thoughts that I shared with you on the previous couple of slides. So, enough about pigs. What about the beef side? So, I was trying to, as I thought about this, I thought, well, gosh, it'd be interesting to take a look and see what kind of progress have we realized in beef cattle production over the last several years. And I really struggled for a while to come up with some sources of data, and then through some previous contacts, Joe Young at Elanco and the AgSpan database that they have, some of you are probably familiar with it, I thought of as a potential source to kind of take a look at the progress the cattle feeding industry has made over the last several years. And so they were very good enough and spent quite a few hours just pulling together a few graphs that I want to share with you over the next few slides. And so these are the parameters of the data set. It's steers only. It's closeout information from Kansas and southeast Colorado taken over the last dozen years. Whoa. Filtered based on initial placement weights of 700 to 849 pounds. Represents a little over 6 million head of cattle. And it's a group closeout information. And so the deads are really discredited through this process. Okay? So, over the last dozen years, this is group closeout average daily gain progress through 2010. So, I'm not going to say anything yet because I drew some conclusions as well. Certainly embedded in that is seasonality, and you see those bounces up and down through there. Also, what's embedded in that, I think we can all kind of think through what breed composition changes have happened over time. Any heterosis that may or may not be present. So all the noise is embedded in there. Now, one might make the argument that here over the last few years, there may be beginning to see some progress in that. I don't know. Time will tell. So that's growth. Feed to gain. Okay? Everybody see those numbers? So this is a little over 6 million head of cattle. Now, think about this slide, and you might can make the argument. It's about 75, 80 pounds, it looks like, of change in final kill weight on steers. So you kind of have to factor that in your mind and look at the previous slide. So maybe there's been some marginal change there. I don't know. I didn't ask them to go and statistically adjust feed conversion based on final average weight. Mortality, there actually does appear to be a little bit of a trend here. This scale is not a big scale, and I don't know if this is a statistically significant or not. But, you know, most feedlot closeouts are probably in this 1 to 2% range anyway, I think that we would routinely look at. Certainly appears to be somewhat of a marginal, at least visual, trend anyway. But it hadn't gotten, that's not something that it looks like at least we can say we've managed any better. So then I asked them, because I had those two slides from the pig data, I said, well gosh, would you break it out based on mortality of the groups? And it looks like to me that about every percent change in mortality, particularly down in here, is really worth about a point of feed conversion. So you can do the math as to what that might be on a group closeout basis. And again, I'd point out that for the most part, you know, most of your data on a routine basis is down in here, unless you get into some really significant health challenges. But I would guess that if you're up in here, that given hopefully decent economic conditions and pricing and feed costs, you're probably losing your rear end up in that category. Okay? And then the same kind of slope I showed you on the pig data with respect to growth. That as mortality easily slides down, so does growth as a consequence. Again, this is group closeout data, so you're not getting credit for the deads. Okay? So, at least my, you know, simple-minded conclusions from looking at the data, there are some similarities to what we see in the pig data. Swings due to mortality, low performance. And I didn't put these slides in, but they do have some ways of going about in those data and trying to estimate morbidity, and they follow generally the same trends, not quite as crystal clear, and I think the data is a little bit noisier, so kind of chalk it up to that. I know morbidity is a big issue for, when we have morbidity, it clearly just drives down feed conversion and growth. I couldn't come to the conclusion that there had been any changes really from a positive standpoint in growth and feed and conversion based on these data across the industry over the last dozen years. So, with that said, and kind of going back to my pig example, I guess some things you may want to consider checking off the list as you move forward in this whole area are just thinking about those types of examples. Does that potential paradigm I explained, one, does it hold any scientific validity? If it does, you know, it's probably something, again, you want to X off and check off the list before you get way too far down the path. So, I thought I'd take my same example, and I may stumble on this a little bit, but thinking about some of the data Mike showed you in the last presentation, and really just kind of putting it in forms of a practical cattle type of example, I think the question you may be posed with. And again, realistically, I'm only interested in any progress I can make on a commercial closeout. Okay? To me, that's the ultimate question for any of the traits. So, hypothetical example here, two different bulls, two different kind of genetic predispositions, if you will. So this is bulls we're talking about, not steers themselves. So we take the first bull, bull A, let's say that, again, they have maybe not full genetic potential available to them, but they can express a fair amount of it. Enough, certainly, we can differentiate them, maybe typical of most purebred operations. Let's say that that's a high lean efficiency type of bull, has really a great lean gain, probably is lean also, probably has fairly high intake type of genetics, if I'm thinking about what we know from the literature, and probably also has relatively high maintenance needs as well, relative to other types of genotypes that are out there and available. We're going to take a second bull, bull B, and under those same types of environments, he's also a high intake type of animal, probably has a little bit less maintenance if we think about that biological type. In this scenario, that bull probably reached maximum lean deposition because he had the opportunity to make that genetic expression, okay? And probably a little bit fatter as well at that same endpoint. We take those two animals, produce a set of steers, and we place them, okay? And we feed them out. And we expose them to maybe some of those greater variations that we see in a commercial feedlot setting of stress, morbidity, you know, gosh, some of that winter slides we saw of those steers and fed heifers covered up in ice and snow. You know, we kind of stress them out a little bit and maybe drive down the intake. So would bull A, the high lean genotype type of bull, on a group closeout information standpoint, would those animals end up with reduced intake, potentially a little bit higher mortality? That would at least be my guess. Probably also still has those same higher maintenance demands, and just like in the pig example, never has the opportunity to reach that maximum protein deposition. Okay? Bull B, a little fatter genotype, a little bit less maintenance. Those incremental pounds, they actually greatly fulfill that lean deposition. At the end of the day, what I'm going to guess, okay, and I don't have the data to prove this, but this is just what I'm throwing out to you, that when you get into this scenario, this might be a more desirable group closeout. Okay? Just something I'm tossing out to this group to think about a little bit. We definitely see it in our data. Okay? I'm going to switch gears just a little bit. Mike shared some data. Some of you had the opportunity to go up to the Circle A feeders yesterday, and this is probably my experience, at least, with feed intake data from a research perspective in beef cattle. The Circle A Sire Alliance, over the years, have shared some presentations with this group about that program. Just as a recap of that, it's a progeny testing program, involves commercial Angus animals. They happen to be pedigreed. Through the Circle 8 Angus Ranch system, about 6,000 cows at three locations. And it's a big, massive progeny test. So we take young Angus sires, AI them throughout the system, beginning at birth, track everything from a terminal standpoint all the way through ultrasound of steers, carcass data, even gather subsamples of shear force information, and then you saw the intake facilities up there yesterday and gather that information as well. Today, this is the progeny testing platform for a very significant majority of the bulls that ABS would acquire. They would test and collect data on these animals through the program. This is the facility itself. It's a confinement facility, a 5,000 head capacity yard, solid floors. We have two pens that we have GrowSafe capabilities in, and at any one time probably measure 2 to 210, 15 head. So we've been gathering those data for the last several years. Just pulled together a quick analysis last week, if you can remember some of Mike's numbers. Now, this is Angus steer data. This isn't bull data, okay? This is Angus feedlot steer data. And these would be animals that they have intake records, the average daily feed intake, ultrasound measurements really at a fixed point in time on those animals as well, and then post-weaning average daily gain, heritabilities for those traits on this diagonal. Okay, so this is commercial level steer growth and intake and ultrasound traits, and then you can see the relationships that exist amongst all of those traits. At least in my mind, I think they all made sense. There isn't anything that's a big surprise there. Intake is a reasonably heritable trait. Average daily gain a little bit lower. And I'll tell you, in a commercial setting, I'm not necessarily too surprised by that. Certainly enough we make genetic progress in. Compute internal EPDs based on all of those data, and more data than this. And those end up going into a terminal sire index. And this is a slide borrowed from Doug Frank. And they look at the bulls in a couple of different ways. Over here on the right side, this is again is a terminal profit index that involves all of those terminal profit traits. And then they have actually kind of compartmentalized it into a feed efficiency index for those that are interested in looking at those sires that combine based on an economic selection index, if you will, the components that make up feed conversion, growth and feed intake. This isn't residual feed intake. This is just a plot of the sire EPD solutions for intake on this axis, going from higher intake to lower, lower to higher growth. And the index really kind of focuses in, I didn't highlight any of them, really on kind of bulls that are out really in this part here. We really don't pick up, unless there's extreme growth, those low intake animals really don't show up as driving forward in the index. So that's the approach that this group has decided to take. A couple more slides and I'll quickly close. I thought it would be interesting to kind of get a perspective on the poultry industry, and I'll tell you, those guys are hard to get anything out of because they certainly operate in a very confidential way and they're extremely competitive, but I know enough of them that I had a few conversations with and tried to gauge their perspective on genetic improvement for feed efficiency and what they see at the commercial level within integrated poultry production. And I really came away with the same conclusion that we've kind of come to, is that they've definitely made progress, and they've selected for it. This happens to be a layer company, genetic trend over time. This is feed conversion here, and then years. So they've made progress. The one big takeaway that I got from them in the communications we had is that they feel like when they've realized that genetic gain, they've created a bird that has less intake. And they view that as a really bad deal throughout their commercial operations. So again, maybe just some more, if you will, anecdotal evidence to kind of support the things I've thrown out. Last thought, just a few random thoughts, if you will. Just a big question I really kind of wanted to throw out today as you guys push forward with selection for efficiency, however you decide to do it. I really think this question or area probably deserves some more attention, just to be sure that you're headed exactly down the right path. We didn't talk much about it, but, you know, intake and efficiency, they're all fairly reasonable related with some other traits. You know, we certainly should probably use them. And then finally, just one comment I'd make, and somebody made a comment today in one of the earlier presentations about this, with respect to, let's say, the cow side, I think about it with respect to the sow. Any response you might realize, or at least, again, this is from the sow perspective, in reducing lactation intake, we think is a bad thing. That's a terribly bad thing. We want an animal that has farrowed and is lactating. When she reaches towards that end of that cycle right before she weans pigs, we want her consuming just as much as she can. I don't care how efficient she is, I want her consuming. Because if she's not doing that, my gilt replacement cost, I'll tell you, is not insignificant. And so if she doesn't get bred back and she exits the system at an early parity, that's a bad deal for all of us. So if you take that thought process, throw it over to the cattle side, at least in my mind, reduced intake during lactation for a breeding female, you know, it certainly could be the first step to reducing pounds of calf wean per cow exposed just through reduced conception rates. So I'm going to quit, and if you have any questions, I don't know if there's any time for them or not, but I'd be happy to try and take them.
Yeah, sure, we got time for questions.
William, do you see any importance in estimating animal-by-animal interaction?
I'm not sure. That's an interesting question. I don't know how well we can do it, Scott.
Yeah, even in the cattle data, the fact that they've all got, they can only access one feeder.
No,
they can't. You might be able to do it.
Yeah, they have access to multiple.
At least to look at its effect on growth.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. Yeah.
Can you back up to the poultry slide that you had there? Would you say they hit a brick wall in 2000 with nowhere to go?
It certainly looks flat past then. This is their public data, so I don't know the details behind the drive forward. I would tell you probably a couple of things that would be my guess is that they may have kind of come to the realization that maybe they didn't hit a brick wall, but maybe based on the way things were going, they maybe didn't need to take that much further.
Question over here.
In cattle, I'm not really sure. That was the focus of some of the questions a bit earlier. I know on the way we do it in the business, we can monitor it and drive it forward through various methods. I'm not sure. I think the bigger thing I guess I'm raising is, are you going to do anything through the process maybe that you push forward with that you might accidentally reduce it?
Did you say you were measuring an individual animals in the commercial setting? I don't know if I caught that right, or is that just in the purebred setting?
So on that slide, it's just in the purebred setting. Any measurement of feed intake we would do in the commercial level, we'd have to go through and do it on a pen-by-pen basis.
John over here. What's the heritability of livability?
It's pretty low. Depends on where we look at it in the system. It's going to be around 5-6% from an additive basis. I tell you the other thing that honestly we do to be sure we've got checked off the list is honestly just exploit heterosis. That's really our first step in genetically assessing and tackling that. In parts of the system where that's not done to 100% perfection in terms of execution, I can show you that there's a downhill slide on livability where that's not done right.
I need Mark.
Maximizing it. Maximizing heterosis. At the maternal production level and then also at the growing pig level.
With your purebred lines, how many crosses maximized efficiency?
I didn't catch the question.
How many crosses until you maximized efficiency or lost it?
How many crosses? The composition on the end market animal? Okay.
Yes,
yep.
Sir.
Yep.
I'm sorry.
So, let's say it's pretty simple. We've got three lines, a terminal line, two maternal lines. Take those two maternal lines, we make an F1 female, gets bred to the terminal line boar and produces a half terminal, half maternal pig. 100% heterosis really is a commercial parent female, 100% in the growing pig. Three. Predominantly three for the bulk of the system. One's a Duroc-based breed. The second's a land race, and then the third's a large white Yorkshire type of breed.
You get more breeds, you get more heterosis. What's the balance?
Depends on those traits. If we're kind of back to livability and some of those reproductive traits, we get more bang for the buck on the heterosis. Those more highly heritable traits, clearly from a selection response standpoint.
William. What I'm wondering, we're talking about some of the negative genetic aspects that can happen, and you've alluded to those. And if we reduce intake to a degree, I guess what I'm wondering is, what's your experience? How much can we go down before we start to see these antagonisms pop up? Because we may be worried about something that we don't need to worry about for a while when we look at genetic response, and actually the development of the EPDs. So I guess, what's your experience and what's your poultry buddies telling you?
So, I'll answer it based on our experience. Be a little cautious how I answer this. We've taken trials, Darrell, where we take sire line A, we go over in let's say, a commercial environment, kind of like that slide that I showed you. We've done this, and we get one set of results. And then we go over to, let's call it an R&D environment, where we give, honestly, you know, we can probably name the pigs. We know them so well. You know, they get all the, you know, the great care, opportunity to eat all day, and, you know, they're really greatly, greatly managed beyond, you know, probably what in reality we can ever really do on a commercial level basis. And we see that, I mean, it really ends up being, you know, those animals, just like in that scenario I showed you. We'll have them flip-flop, re-rank with respect to feed conversion. So it doesn't take much to see any impact whatsoever. And we see also those trade-offs in livability.
So is it a combination, though, of feed intake as well as composition that's interacting there to cause that
thing? I don't know if it's an interaction or just really one or the other. They're kind of, I roll them a little bit together. In my mind. Okay.
Here we go.
William, from what you're saying, I may have a couple questions or a follow-up question possibly. You've measured intake, and you specifically said Duroc, your boars.
Well,
are you measuring intake on maternal lines as well?
We've done it. We do it with all the lines, but we do it with our terminal lines.
Have you put selection pressure on the maternal lines?
We keep it in check. So the answer is from a pressure standpoint of reducing it, absolutely not.
So you're trying to optimize that in some form?
It's probably a pretty fair assessment.
On the maternal side, but then you would put more selection pressure from the terminal side on intake?
It honestly depends on your commercial production system and how big of an issue that is for you. Okay? That's a pretty vague answer. If that's an opportunity for your commercial production system, then yeah, we're probably going to tweak it some. We don't want to do anything to drive it back the other way based on the way we select animals. Today we feel reasonably okay about where that is. So selection and genetic improvement doesn't always mean changing something for us.
So maybe back, I'm not sure, maybe along the lines of Stroh's question, for you or your company, you're mainly gathering intake data to monitor it, to not increase intake possibly, and to tweak it in the cases where you might need to.
Yeah, I'll answer it this way. We're not driving forward selecting for RFI or reduced intake that inherently is going to, you know, that some might think it would impact efficiency. We're not taking that approach. There are those that do.
William, one more over here. We have discussions going on related to feed efficiency or feed intake as it relates to a growing, developing bull or steer versus what's going to happen out in the pasture with forage intake, with the pig industry probably having a little higher concentrate or energy level on finishing diets than what they do on lactating sow diets. What relationship have you seen, or if you haven't measured it, tell us, that's fine, but what kind of experience are you seeing between the growing, developing, finishing pig versus the lactating sow?
I'll just give you some anecdotal comments, okay? In the sow, we kind of tie it back to, one, her genetic body composition and her degree of lactate, her degree of milk output as well. That's where you begin to, you know, that balance of intake has to be pushed forward further and harder. So it's really driven by that. Today we don't have a set of information, let's say that, I know what your question is, that we can link this set of measurements over here with this specific set of measurements and tell you what the genetic relationship is. Not in the exact way I know you're asking it.
I've got another follow-up question. Okay. In your your historic perspective, from your understanding of where you've been in the hog industry, maybe your historic perception of where we are, maybe with your analysis of the Circle 8 data, where are we in the beef industry, and where do we need to be going from a feed intake or a feed efficiency standpoint? What is your perception of where we need to be headed?
I got to answer that. I don't know. And honestly, that's why I'm raising the questions, because I don't know specifically the answers to them.
Do we need to be concerned?
I think, like I said before, I think you have to check it off the list. You know, do you have a study put in place today? I mean, you're far enough along in being able to compute some of the numbers where you've gone through and tracked closeout information. I mean, at the end of the day, I'll tell you, we have five key strategies that we run our business on, okay? And I'll tell you one of those is. And if we fail on this one, I promise you I won't be working for Smithfield anymore. You know, we have to achieve commercial level genetic gain. And, you know, I think that's something that this group probably needs to feel comfortable with. You checked off the list. You know, I don't know if you can use some of that feedlot data to really probably raise some further emphasis on that question or not. Because it doesn't look like to me necessarily that anything's changed in the growing animal very much, based on those data that those guys were kind enough to pull together. You're not going to give up, are you?
I told Robert I wasn't going to ask any more questions. Well, back to the Circle A data. And I probably haven't studied it here closely just as of recent. What is the correlation between your... Is it feed intake index or feed efficiency index?
Yeah.
To profitability, then.
I'd have to pull that specific number to tell you. It's reasonably high. And part of that equation is a yield grade EPD as well. And so that honestly drags in some other things along with lean efficiency. I'll tell you that, in part, in answering your previous question, with that facility you saw yesterday, we do have in place today a more data-friendly mechanism for tracking morbidity and mortality, and that's something that at least that group internally is going to attempt to try and answer over time. But we don't have the answers for it right now.